But please hold your calls for a few minutes. We have with us Dr. Bruce Halstead. And Dr. Halstead is a world-renowned toxicologist. He's studied certainly the effects of various products for many, many years. And tonight we're going to be talking about something that was introduced into America 20, 30, maybe more years ago than that. But I remember when we first started hearing about Laetrile and there was a gentleman who had been one of the most prominent physicians in America. His name was Dr. Ivey, back at the University of Chicago. But he'd become a quack, and he was making tremendous profits pushing a drug called Laetrile. It was used to ensnare desperate people with terminal carcinoma into turning their funding over to the doctors. And anybody who used Laetrile was obviously marginalized and demonized. And once you hear all of these things, and you sort of wonder in the back of your mind. They even had pictures in the Journal of the American Medical Association and newspapers of Dr. Ivey's home, and it certainly looked like an awfully nice home. And obviously, the inference was, of course, that he and other doctors who were using Laetrile in those days were doing it only for personal profit. Well, sometimes what we read in the newspapers and what we read in magazines isn't true, even if it's in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Dr. Halstead, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Pleasure.
Well, why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about you? Now, this is a completely new audience. You haven't talked to them before. The audience makes up a large part of the state of Washington and northern Oregon and the western part of Idaho, and then, of course, across America on the miracle of Internet, and then here in the central coast of California. So why don't you sort of tell our listeners who you are and what your background is?
Well, I graduated from University of California, Berkeley, in zoology, went into medicine, graduated in 1948 in the School of Medicine at Loma Linda University. After I got out, I got into the field of tropical medicine and was working with the various mission bodies all over the world. In fact, I ended up, by the time I got through with some of that work, plus the work I was doing with the military, I'd traveled in about 150 countries of the world. Most of my work professionally has been in the field of biotoxicology, biological poisons. And we work here at the World Life Research Institute, where I'm now the director. I work with many different very deadly compounds that are used or potentially useful in the field of biological or chemical warfare. A lot of my work also got involved in the field of traditional medicine, and I'm very well acquainted and have an enormous library here in the field of traditional medicine, Chinese herbology, Japanese, Vietnamese, Cambodian, and so on and so forth. I became involved early in the 70s, or even before that, with Laetrile. Now, to tell you what I'm really trying to discuss is, I'm not discussing so much Laetrile. I'm not trying to sell it. I'm not trying to recommend it. I'm merely trying to give you a scientific and historical background on what Laetrile is all about. Laetrile is a cyanogenic glycoside that is found in the pits of over 1,200 plants, 73 different plant families. During the course of the usual activity, most people have ingested sometime during the course of a day or a week or days amygdalin, which is equated with Laetrile. And the reason we're discussing Laetrile is not because of its potential use in the field of cancer, but we're discussing really the constitutional rights of the individual patient in the United States, the right under the 5th and the 14th Amendment, the right of privacy. The right of privacy does not appear anywhere in the Constitution, but the U.S. Supreme Court has decided and determined that under the 5th and 14th Amendments, people have the right to choose. And this is what is meant by right of privacy. They have the right to choose the form of therapy that they're going to use. The reason why we're discussing Laetrol is because our rights, our constitutional rights, are being eroded away because of a monopoly. Now, when I say the American Medical Association or American medicine is a monopoly, the average individual is not familiar with the subject study. Well, I can't believe that. Well, it's been determined four different times by the United States Supreme Court, the Federal Trade Commission. And if you look at the Barnes Report and the Federal Trade Commission, it goes in very intensely that shows how all of these state medical societies, the federal medical societies, whatever they may be, exist as a monopoly. And that means that you do not have the right to choose. What you choose will be determined for you. And this is part of the problem. So this is what we're discussing. This is my background.
All right, fine. Well, of course, now what is the basically the history of Laetrol? When did anybody finally decide that it might be beneficial in the treatment of cancer? Certainly this has actually been used in other cultures for really for centuries, hasn't it? I understand there's some cultures where a very, very low incidence of cancer,
absolutely.
And people, they got it from apricot pits.
Well, I've traced it back and I have documents to prove it in the great Chinese materia medica known as the Pensao Gong Mu, that you can trace it back for over 3,000 years. So there's nothing new about it. And it's so widely distributed, the people of Hunza eat apricot kernels like peanuts. And what you've really got here is you've got something that threatens the medical business integrity of the cancer industry. And we don't know exactly what cancer costs the American public, but we have estimates as high as $200 billion a year. That's a pretty good-sized industry. And anything, whatever it may be, whether Laetrol is only one of many, many items, you got to remember that cancer and now AIDS, because there's certain similarities there, is a sacred cow of the cancer industry. And anything that threatens to remove money from there or come up with successes that have not been blessed by the pontifical medical establishment is a threat.
Well, now, of course, you as a physician and I as a physician, I'm sure would agree that most doctors really are concerned about their patients, and I've never known a doctor who would intentionally hurt one of his patients. I'm sure there may be a few of them around, but there are not very many of them. I mean, most of them are really dedicated, and most of them try to do their best, don't you think?
Yes, and may I say in my remarks that I'm not accusing any physician or groups of physicians of being monsters that are out there trying to damage the patients or withhold. You see, it's sort of like communism, and I used to be somewhat of an authority in communism and training our military medical officers. What happens is that you begin to develop a certain opinion, a political opinion about something. And gradually, it's like Hitler and Goering said, if you believe, listen to a lie long enough, you begin to believe it. And it's not that these people are plotting and planning to withhold something from the patient that needs it very desperately. It's a combination of ignorance. In other words, they really don't scientifically know anything about Laetrol or amygdalin. They don't know the value of it. They don't know how to even use it. They don't know the history of it. They certainly don't know and understand that it has an ethnobotanical background. So this gets into a situation where you are following a sort of a protocol, a political protocol, a scientific protocol. You got to do this and this and this. And if it isn't toxic, then it wouldn't certainly work.
Well, of course, the traditional methods of treating cancer, you cut it out, you burn it out, or you poison it.
That's correct.
And, of course, that's the way I was trained in the treatment of cancer. I never liked to treat cancer. In fact, that's why I became an orthopedic surgeon, because I just felt that I got so involved with the patients, and then you get to like them and you get to know them, and then they die, and it takes a very special person to be an oncologist to be willing month in, month out, year in, year out, to treat people who are dying, and many of them are going to die no matter what you do. Some of them you will help with the conventional methods, but there is this concept that Laetrile, a natural occurring food substance you get out of apricot pits, and what, do you get it in berries? Where else do you get it?
Well, you can get it, as I say, from 1,200 species of plants, and involving 74 major plant families. It's one of myriads of compounds that are found in natural products. Right now I'm doing a major study on Amazon medicinal plants, poisonous ones. And I find in the Amazon forest, the jungles, the natives have many compounds that work against cancer. It's documented. They're not all Laetrile. There are all sorts of compounds. And the restrictions go back to the protocol, the testing protocol that is followed by the National Cancer Institute. And I asked them, we have in the plant world things called adaptogens. These are particularly in the Orient, in India, China, Japan. These are compounds that have a natural inhibitory and normalizing effect on the body. And I called the National Cancer Institute because I'm well acquainted with them. Over the years, I've done some work with them. And I said, do you folks work with adaptogens? Now, this was about a year and a half ago. And the man who was the head of the natural products section, he says, what do you mean by adaptogens? I said, well, I'm using the Oriental terms. Have a normalizing effect. I said, do you test for this or do you only test for toxicity and a cancer compound? He said, well, we normally test for toxicity. If it isn't toxic, we don't use it. I said, well, the way the Chinese work with this, because I'm a consultant to the Chinese military in this, I said, they use it in form, they look upon these as superior plants, they're not toxic, and have a normalizing effect. He said, well, we don't do that kind of testing. He said, I'm not sure exactly how we proceed with it. So I left him with a question, don't you think it would be a good idea to do that type of testing? And he said, yeah, maybe we ought to explore that. But you see, you grow up, and you're taught certain things in medicine, in science, in toxicology, in carcinology. You normally use certain procedures. And when somebody comes up, or a culture or a group of people come up and say, well, we'd like to use something else, that sort of rattles the cage, and it disturbs the stability of the program.
Well, I think that people have to understand that at the beginning of the 20th century, about 100 years ago, it was said that 1 in 25 people died of cancer. Today, about 1 in 5 die of cancer. And since we started our war on cancer, the incidence of cancer has risen. And people say, oh, that's simply because, people are growing older. But is that why we're having more cancer today?
No, that's not true at all.
Oh, no, I was hoping that's what you were going to say.
Yeah, no, because
right.
I was for a while, for 5 years, I was a senior consultant in toxicology of the World Health Organization. We were dealing with 150 nations of the world. And our job at that time was to take a look. We started out looking at petrochemicals. We're trying to find out what is the damage being done to on a global basis to our environment, and in terms of petroleum. And pretty soon we got into petrochemicals. We really don't know how many chemical agents are out there. We've had estimates as high as I don't know, maybe 50 million, and I'm totally guessing because that figure may be grossly incorrect. But we have an enormous number, and we find that the more we generate, industry generates these chemical compounds. For example, we have 50,000 types, chemical agents, known as pesticides. We have molluscicides. We have insecticides. We have things that kill birds, kill this and kill that, and kill rabbits and snakes and everything. If you look at these compounds are basically carcinogenic, almost without exception. They're getting in the environment. So it's not the fact that you're growing older. You can grow as old as the hills. I can show you people in Hunza, they're very elderly. They're not all dying of cancer because they're not being exposed to these chemical compounds.
And don't these chemical compounds alter our immune system? And, of course, we need an intact immune system to be able to stave off cancer.
Well, one of the reasons, looking at the overall view of cancer, and there are many, many different types of cancer, there's myriads of types, we find that if you take a cancer chemotherapeutic agent, and I can say this almost without exception, and I think I've looked at all of them. One of two things they produce. They either produce cancer, or they lower your immune system, or both. The reason you have cancer is because you've been exposed to a carcinogenic agent and your immune system is shot.
And so we treat it then with chemotherapy, which suppresses the immune system.
Which is molecular, pure molecular illogic. If you can sit and explain that to me, then you can explain, I don't know what all, the man in the moon.
Well, let's get on into a discussion, because that's really the background I wanted to lay for our listeners this evening. And then, of course, let's then get off into a discussion of Laetrile. Now, my interest in that really originated with a gentleman that you knew very well. His name was Dr. Dean Burke, and he was in charge of chemotherapy research at NCI, National Cancer Institute.
Oh, yes, and wonderful guy.
Back about
that. Smoked a cigar all the time.
Carcinogenic, but
yeah,
anyway.
I knew him well.
Back 1980, I had read in one of my magazines that there was a fellow at NCI who was saying that Laetrile was an effective treatment. Well, I didn't even know what NCI was. Orthopedists don't usually deal with the National Cancer Institute. So I started inquiring around and found out it was a division of the National Institute of Health or related to it. And so I actually put a call in, and Dr. Burke was kind enough to call me back. And so I asked him, I said, well, does this really work? He said, of course it works. He said, I've got filing cabinets full of documentation that works, and I'm in charge of the chemotherapy research at NCI. So I said to him, well, but what about the Sloan-Kettering study? I mean,
Dr. Sugiura.
Right. And he said that was fixed to prove that Laetrile didn't work, and it does work. And so that really intrigued me, and through the years I've done a little bit of research, but nothing like Dr. Halstead, because he's been on the front lines of this discussion for many years. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the scientific studies that were done, which showed the effectiveness of Laetrile, and then how those were negated by the Sloan-Kettering Institute and the cancer establishment.
Yeah, well, there was a very elegant Japanese scientist that was testing, Sloan Kettering, that was testing various types of anti-cancer agents on mice. And he conducted a study, and the study showed that the mice that were inoculated with Laetrile, amygdalin, it inhibited metastases. In other words, it inhibited the spread of the cancer. Well, Sloan Kettering didn't like this at all. So they discarded his studies. Now, his studies were not published because the powers that be didn't want them published. But they came out through various individuals, Dr. Moss and others that were working there, and the information finally got out that Laetrile positively worked in this inhibiting the spread of cancer on these mice. So then they went, Chester Stock was involved in it, plus several others. They redid his studies. They trashed his studies, and they developed a system where it didn't work.
But didn't they design it?
That was well published.
Didn't they design it so that it wouldn't work? In other words, they didn't want it to work.
They didn't, positively didn't want it to work. Because this is, you know, you're eroding away the financial economic base of cancer therapy. So why are they going to let this happen?
So you see, the logical thing for most of our listeners, and a lot of our listeners coming from a Christian or Judeo-Christian background, would say, well, but everybody would want to help suffering humanity. I mean, that was what doctors do. They're supposed to try to help, and I believe most doctors that feel that way feel very, very strongly. But here in the center sometimes, there seems to be a different attitude. Some of the people look at the world, have a different view of the world. Would you say that might be a more accurate way of putting it?
Yeah, it's a nice way of putting it. You got to remember that there's an economic base. These big cancer institutes and many of the universities that have huge cancer programs, they get to the place that mentally where they think that if I do this, that's the correct way because everybody says it's the correct way. I will fit into the middle. I'm not going to be an offshoot. I'm not going to be looked at as a nitwit that's out there, a radical, an extreme leftist or extreme rightist, but I like to follow the main wing of the program. And eventually they succumb. It's a mental. Well, it goes back to, like I said earlier, the Hitler, that if you believe a lie long enough, you think it's truth, and it's not. And it's these dissenters, they've been around from time immemorial. I'm looked upon by a lot of people as a sort of a radical or a dissenter, not mainstream, and sometimes you suffer the consequences of that. But that's just part of the price you pay. So it gets back to their testing protocol. And the subject we're discussing tonight is a subject that is not following the cancer protocol. And when you get into that sort of a situation, you get problems. And that's what this issue is all about. It's not a matter of selling. I haven't made a dime off of Laetrile. Not a dime. I have used it under the Bohannon affidavit system, which was an operation before the FDA finally knocked it down, took it to a higher court, and because of political pressure, Bohannon, who had set up Judge Bohannon, Luther Bohannon, a marvelous man, was in his court, testified. Great guy who was primarily concerned with the patient. He didn't give a toot about it. He made the statement one time in there in the court. He said, you know, doctor, he said, just because the FDA says it so doesn't mean it is so. And he said, I am interested here. And he decided under the 5th and 14th Amendment that the cancer patient had a right to privacy, a right to choose. And that was later struck down.
In other words, what they held was that the cancer patient doesn't have a right to choose. He doesn't have a right to do with his body as he wants to. He will accept the treatment as it is given to him. In fact, here in the state of California, they've got all sorts of laws that we can't even really advocate the use of these things, or we become medical quacks, and people can lose their licenses for
this sort of thing. I did lose my license on this, because I merely recommended a vegetable product that had been involved, that's been going for thousands of years. I didn't sell it. They claimed I did, but I didn't. They claimed I made $20
million. $20
million? Yeah, I wish I could find that money, because my banker would like to know where it is, too, because I have debt. So it's a strange thing. But since you brought up the state of California, California state has the most rigid anti-cancer laws, or cancer laws, in the United States.
They call them the cancer quack laws, something like
that. Yeah, and I can cite one for you, California, the 1707.1 and 26463. And I was indicted under both of those laws. But 1707.1 is scary, and people need to know about it. Let me give you an example. If I'm in a supermarket, and I'm going down the vegetables there, and I come across the cruciferous vegetables, cabbage, sprouts, broccoli, and if I tell you, you see this cabbage, I could tell you the rest of that cabbage, and that cabbage contains the diethylthione product. It also contains sulforaphane, and they are potent anti-cancer compounds.
In other words, if you eat them, they will cut
they
down
dramatically.
They will
help prevent cancer, and they will help to protect your liver against carbon tetrachloride. They have anti-radiation properties, but it's illegal to tell you that. And if I don't sell it to you, I can give it to you. The issue is not the fact that you're making money. Because I don't run the supermarket. But if I go through and say, this will positively help you, I'm in violation of the law.
And people really don't understand that.
Well, people are grossly ignorant. And the average person, as far as understanding of what the government's about, what they're doing, and this and that and the other thing, they're grossly ignorant. I'm sorry. If that insults people, fine. You've been insulted.
But the tragedy is that if you were eat these things regularly, and especially the less you cook them, why, the better off they are for you, you'll dramatically decrease your incidence of cancer.
Absolutely guaranteed. And this is why they talk about beta-carotene, the yellow-colored vegetable. Now, let me tell you a case, because I use this in the court. I unfortunately hired an idiot for an attorney. I went in as my own attorney in pro per, which was the stupidest dang thing I could have done. And I blame no one for that except me. The National Cancer Institute got together with the Federal Trade Commission, and they asked W.K. Kellogg, Cornflakes, the boys, all brand, if they would be willing to put the following statement on the back of their all brand box. I've got the thing, I've got the letters from the FDA, I've got the letters from the California Cancer Governor's Cancer Commission, I've got the letters from the Trade Commission, so I know precisely what I'm talking about.
All right, I'm going to have to interrupt you, but I'm sure that our listeners will be hanging on to until we get back here tell the rest of the story. But right now we have to take a break, so you guys have to stand back here at Radio Liberty, I guess, this evening. Dr. Bruce Halstead, and of course we're talking about the laws in California, these laws which are to prevent doctors from making claims about their products. And Dr. Halstead was talking about I believe it was Kellogg wanted to put some sort of a message on the back of their product. Would you like to pick up the rest of the story?
Surely. The Kellogg Cornflakes, W.K. Kay Kellogg. I knew the guy originally when he was quite elderly and blind at the time. Anyway, the National Cancer Institute, with the endorsement of the Federal Trade Commission, came to Kellogg and said, would you be willing to put a message on the back of your box, all brand box, saying that we have good news for you? I have the box, the whole works here. And we would like to tell the people that by taking more fiber in their diet would help reduce colon cancer. And they said, W.K. Kellogg said, yeah, we'll be very happy to. And then they checked it with the Federal Trade Commission, which is concerned with truth and honesty and advertising. And they endorsed it. Well, somebody brought a box of All Brand to the attention of the Governor's Advisory Commission in Cancer, Sacramento. And they said, we're disturbed by this ad because it's sort of making claims. It's not honest. It's not quite correct. And it got into the bureaucracy and the threat of the, essentially, the medical authorities. So they wrote to Food and, I have the letter. They wrote to the head of the commission, wrote to the Food and Drug Administration, said, we have an advisory body of, I don't know what, 18 physicians or whatever they had. And we're concerned about this ad. We think it's misleading. We think that this is not entirely correct. There's some hidden, there's a hidden agenda here. We think this is a cheap sales device of the W.K. Kellogg. Now, it happens that All Brand is the gold standard in the cereal industry, so this is not a cheap product.
Well, but the other thing is, though, it really does decrease the incidence of colon cancer.
That's correct.
Right.
But you see, under 1707.1, since this is not an approved drug, it's illegal in the state of California. But what is serious about this is that people, here is an endorsement, not didn't come from some quack organization say, sell my products, put in this ad. This came from the National Cancer Institute. More than that, the National Cancer Institute had checked it with the Federal Trade Commission, honesty and advertising. They said, are you in agreement with this? They said, yeah. So they took it up, and it made a big splatter in Washington. And I have internal letters from the Department of Health and Welfare in Washington at the time, and they said, you know what? And writing to the National Cancer Institute, here's the FDA, FTC, NCI, talking among themselves. What are we going to do about this? It's correct. It seems like we're between a rock and a hard place. Now, this is a direct quotation. We're between a rock and a hard place. What are we going to do about it? So finally, they, I don't know, simmered it down, watered it down a little bit. But here's the serious part of this. Here, the American people are being denied the facts that would help to prevent their lives, that would give them health. What kind of a monopoly is this? Talk about criminal activity. This is the worst type.
Well,
That's what bothers me.
I laugh because I fought the battle of the California Medical Association for almost 15 years as the senior delegate from my county to the House of Delegates of the California Medical Association.
Mm-hmm.
And time again, I would come up and say, you know, this will help people's health. You know, let's just tell them there's a possibility of, say, a first trimester abortion increasing breast carcinoma, although there was tremendous evidence that there was a relationship. And do you think that they would do that? Or no. Even when the doctors would vote on something that they almost universally agreed on, then there'd be somebody within the hierarchy of organized medicine who had a different agenda. And I suddenly realized it really didn't matter whether science was on your side. Even if you convinced all the doctors, it took me a decade to convince them that we needed a public health policy to stop the AIDS epidemic instead of the stupid things we were doing. And even though I got a standing ovation from all the members of the House of Delegates of the California Medical Association, that was my last year there, for finally prevailing, the hierarchy refused to do what was right to save human lives. That's the AIDS industry out there. So, I share your concerns that, and it's not that the average doctor isn't concerned. He just is so busy. He doesn't have a chance to realize what goes on behind the scenes or really the devious things that are done in his name by his so-called organization.
Well, let me take you a little behind the scenes. A few years before my court battle there with the state, I was working on trying to get a bill approved that would approve through the legislature that they would be able to use Laetril in the state of California. We were working through William Campbell from Hacienda Heights at that time, and we asked for his support to get this bill, and I appeared before the legislature to discuss the merits of the thing. And he said, I got a problem. He said, if I support this bill, he said, I will lose $10,000 from the lobbyists of the AMA and CMA.
Right.
So what am I going to do? Well, the group that I was with said, well, we'll give you $10,000 if you'll push it. Well, it ends up that we pushed it but didn't get the bill approved. Because, again, you come back to dollars. And that's the issue. But in the meantime, what we're doing by prostituting ourselves in this manner, we're losing our rights to our health, our liberty, our thinking, our speech, the 14th Amendment. This was proven in the federal court.
But the thing is that even if it didn't work, people should have a right to be wrong. I believe that certainly all the evidence is on the...
Well, you should have the right to fail.
Right, sure. But there is people with a vested financial interest, and I'm not talking about doctors, but I am talking about an industry that really has done everything they could to block a logical and truly compassionate approach to this disease, because I will tell you the people who take chemotherapy, some of them say, I'd rather die than go through that again. Let's go to Don, who's calling us from Washington, Spokane, Washington. Hi, Don. How are you doing?
Pretty good, Dr. Stan. How are you tonight?
Fine. Just speak up a little louder.
Okay. I've got three questions for your guest. Would he agree that chemotherapy is nitrogen mustard gas that was outlawed by the Geneva Convention?
Well, there are many types of chemotherapy, but
where it all started, right? With mustard gas.
Sure, okay.
It was a war gas, which incidentally was internationally banned.
Yes.
All and right. when the war was over, the war gas industry went in two directions. One direction is they went in agricultural pesticides. This is one direction they went. The other direction was they went into cancer chemotherapy.
Well, how much of chemotherapy
well
today?
Documented.
How much of chemotherapy today is nitrogen gas or nitrogen?
Oh, a small part.
Right. But originally
we have now analogs of everything under the sun.
Right. But originally it was, Don. So anything, what's the second and third question?
Would he agree with the second dose of chemotherapy is always 100% fatal?
The second dose?
No, in other words, if it fails the first time, I'm going to give it to you a second time.
In my experience, they've let people go after their first. They say, your cancer's finally cured now that you're almost dead. And they let them go for a couple of years till they get well and healthy again. Then they say, your cancer's back again, and I've not known anyone to survive the second round of chemo. 100%.
Let me tell you a set of statistics that you will never come across. I guarantee it. You will never be able to determine the number of people that died of the treatment rather than the disease. And I will guarantee you that there are more people dying of the treatment than there is of those that died of the disease. You see, it's a 5-year cure. That means that if you lasted through whatever method 5 years and you die a week later, you're cured.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really,
you see the statistic, you know, liars don't figure, figures don't lie, but liars figure. It's the same old deal. The statistics are corrupted. All you've got to do is look at the works of Baylor and Smith of Harvard University. These are two magnificent biostatisticians. And they will show you that those figures, we are under a delusion as to what we're accomplishing. To begin with, if we take the best, choriocarcinoma, Hodgkin's disease, some of the leukemias, we only do well in about 8% of the cancers. God knows how many different cancers there are out there. But we only do about, well in about 8% of them. All of the rest of them, we haven't made any progress. The biostatisticians, the honest ones, will admit that we have lost the cancer war, which Nixon started. There was a study a while back in Europe among oncologists, and they found that the professional oncologists don't take cancer chemotherapy. They don't follow the stuff they give out. Something's radically wrong.
Okay, King John, do you have a third question?
Yes. Would you agree that those who do take chemotherapy die from chemotherapy poisoning rather than from cancer?
Well, what they found is that a lot of the people die from other types of cancer. In other words, they may cure one type of cancer, because there's a statistical number there that will be cured of that, only to find out years later they die of a different type. It may be a form of leukemia or whatever. So it's a sticky problem. It's not clean, and it's not nice.
No, but I mean, I've known people who've taken chemotherapy, and one of my very good friends took it recently, and he's, at least for the time being, he's doing quite well. But cancer is a systemic disease, and it involves far more than simply the local growth.
That's
what we're really going to be talking about through the rest of the program. So, do you have anything else you'd like to say? Because certainly I would agree with you, and I think Dr. Halstead would, but as well that there's much to be desired in the current methods and approaches to cancer therapy, but any other methods are being effectively banned, especially here in California where I live.
Well, I read a statistic once that if people are diagnosed with cancer and do nothing, they live an average of 12 years. If they are diagnosed with cancer and undergo chemotherapy, their average life expectancy is about 4 years.
Well, there was a radiologist back in the probably 40s or 50s at the University of California. And he decided, and had statistics to prove it, that you're better off to not take radiation. You'll live longer and you'll live better with better quality of life.
And, of course, he was a cancer radiologist?
Yeah.
What was his name? I'm trying to think of his name. Joan something. I forgot it. We had one of the guys that won the Nobel Prize on the... double helix. Wasson, I think his name. Anyway, somebody asked him, he's a Nobel Prize winner now and working in the field of cancer, and they asked him one day, and it came out in the newspaper, what do you think of our cancer program? You know what he said? It's a bunch of shit.
Okay, that's a very graphic description. Anything else, Don?
No.
All right, fine.
I would like to say, I hate to say this to two doctors, but I haven't been in a doctor's office for 30 years, and the next doctor that sees me is going to be a medical examiner. That's how much faith I have in the medical community.
Don, there is a place for medicine.
You seem a little serious.
Especially since I was an orthopedic surgeon, and orthopedists sort of like the carpenters of medicine, and believe me, orthopedists do a lot of good, and there are certain things that doctors can do to help you.
Well, I know. If something's broke, you go to a mechanic and get it fixed. But as far as going in and get a diagnosis, I can do that myself. And there's only two outcomes. I'm either going to get well or I'm going to die.
Well, I think you can do a little better trying to prevent things.
Yeah, and that's really, if you listen to our programs and some of our programs on diet and things like that.
Exactly.
Right. You just keep listening, Don. God bless you. We hope that that you're not going to be seeing that medical examiner too soon.
Thanks a lot. Good night, Don.
Right, God bless you. Okay, fine. Well, that was Don calling in from Spokane, and I believe that medicine has made some wonderful progress, but certainly not in this field.
Oh, in many fields.
Right. But we're talking specifically about the field of cancer.
Yeah. Well, we are, in a strange sort of way, we're learning a lot about the basic science of cancer, the biology of it. How does it function? How does it react? We're learning a lot of things. Everything is not negative. Tonight we're sort of dwelling on certain things that are really not so much cancer research as it is constitutional values.
Right. Well, we've got Theodora calling in from Santa Cruz. Hi, Theodora. How are you?
Hi, Dr. Stan.
Good to hear you from you again.
Well, and I do listen to you a lot, so whether I call in or not, we're out here. I'm very down on mammograms, and I wanted to hear what your guest had to say about mammograms. It doesn't make sense to me that we should be pouring that much radiation into our chests on an annual basis. When we know that radiation contributes to cancer.
No, what are your thoughts on that?
You're absolutely correct, and I'm trying to think the name of a physician who's an expert also in nuclear medicine, radiation, University of California.
John Goffman?
John Goffman, marvelous man. He has written quite a number of books, and if you read, and I think I have all of them, I know the guy by phone. You'll see that mammograms are probably part of the cause of the increased incidence of breast cancer. And I have no doubt about that. I have studied a lot of his material, which is superb. He's an MD, PhD, now an elderly man. He was part of the Manhattan Project, and there were some studies conducted there. There's a series of books that I think that you folks need to know about, and that is the Presidential Reports on Plutonium and Radiation in Humans. This was under the Clinton administration, and Clinton selected a group of people, none of whom were officially connected with government. And he said, I want you to go through all of the classified reports dating back into the Manhattan Project. This is the development of the atom bomb, which I've studied intensely. And I want you to find out what we have done to people in the use of radiation. This is a little bit of what they found. I have all the volumes sitting on my shelf.
Well, where can we get those, incidentally?
You can get them from the United States government printing office.
Okay, are they expensive?
I think I paid maybe a total of about $80 for, I think it was about 6 volumes.
Okay, that's pretty good price.
But believe me, it is some of the best money you're going to spend. Listen what they did. They injected plutonium into pregnant women without their permission. The biological half-life of plutonium is 1 billion years. Quaker Oats Company, and one of the largest, I think it was one of the largest hospitals in Boston, fed plutonium-laced cookies to little children, and the parents did not know what they were eating. There were several thousand other people that were exposed. They brought a little boy, 14 years old, to the University of California in San Francisco and injected the kid with plutonium. He had an osteosarcoma. And John Goffman has told me the story, but I'd already known it, and I have a video on this thing. One of the horrible things, the kid died, and they essentially, the government dumped him. And the mother had a hard time trying to figure out. They flew him over originally in a military aircraft. And when after the kid died, she had a hard time trying to figure out how to get home back to Australia.
Well, can I ask
these are the things that is documented evidence.
Right.
The American public don't know doodly squat about these.
Well, one of the giveaways is when they're willing to send a mammogram van around the neighborhoods to make it easy for women to get this. You gotta distrust it. Anytime they're, you know, anybody who follows the history of public health and the FDA knows that if they're making it easy for you to get the service like with vaccinations or mammograms, chances are you better look twice at what it's really about.
Well, it's pretty sickening, and I think if you look at the radiological facts, you'll see that the mammograms are a very dangerous thing to do.
And what would you recommend? I've heard of thermography.
There are other methods of thermography.
Would you mention some of them? I'm going to take my answer off the air, but if you could mention, steer us women, because we certainly are being, you know, made to be careful all the time.
I don't have it all at my fingertips, but John Goffman, who resides in San Francisco, is a guy that you could get in touch with. He knows more about this subject, and of course the radiologists and the orthodox medical people don't like him. I wonder why.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you know of any alternative methods, maybe just mention them.
I would contact John Goffman.
Oh, okay.
I would bow to his
Send us to the main man. Well, thank you again, Dr. Stan.
Okay, maybe we can get Dr. Goffman on.
He's the guy that you need.
Well, I hope I tune in that night.
Okay,
I'd love to hear what he says. Thank you.
I'd certainly get a hold of John Goffman.
Right, fine. Well, you know, there's a book. Do you know it? It's called The Plutonium Files.
I've heard of the book.
It covers much of what you say, and I've been sitting on my desk, and I've been sort of looking at it. It's about 3 inches thick, so I've been a little reluctant to read it, but of course it covers much of what you said. I think we probably better read it and get the author on the program so we can go into great detail.
I'll tell you why I like the Clinton presidential studies on radioactive materials and humans, their effects on humans, because this comes from scientists from the Department of Energy, the Department of Defense. You can't argue with the authorities because none of these people are outselling anything. This is one of the great things that I think Clinton did and doesn't get any credit for.
Going into the background of course, Laetrile and some of the other things that we've touched on, the fact that there are many things you can do to avoid getting cancer. And certainly adequate diet is at the very, very top of that. And there's a great deal out there to demonstrate in controlled scientific and peer-reviewed scientific studies that a proper diet, using many of the foods we've already talked about, tomatoes has a tremendous impact on preventing cancer of the prostate, which is why my wife gives me tomatoes every day, and why it's so important that we eat and eat properly. But this is not stressed, and all you need to do is see what's happened to the incidence of cancer since the beginning of the 20th century, when the figures were about 1 in 25 died of cancer, and now 1 in 5, or maybe it's even more than that. Are those figures pretty accurate, Dr. Halstead?
Well, cancer statistics, in my humble opinion, are not too accurate, no matter where you get them from. Every year I get the National NCI facts book, and it gives you all the statistics. But statisticians that have analyzed those figures will be the first to tell you that they're not too reliable. Because it's this business, well, I lasted 5 years, but I died the day after in the sixth year. And this is where the statistics just aren't any good. You're not learning how many died of the treatment versus how many died of the disease. That's the problem with the statistics.
Well, let's get on into Laetril. Now, Laetril was used by a certain number of doctors, though. I remember in the 60s it was being used, as I remember. Who was it? Was it Dr. Krebb who actually hypothesized that this was good? Well,
yes, it was Krebb Sr., and then he was joined by Krebs Jr. I knew Krebb Jr. very well, a very fine person. He was accused of all sorts of things. But let me go into the historical for just a moment to show you the problem. In 1977, the commissioner, the Food and Drug Administration commissioner, made a study, and he went into the history, and they had, and still do, two clauses, the drug clauses. First of all, I need to tell you the difference between a food and a drug. There's no real scientific difference. The difference, legally, is the intent of the use. For example, if you use a product, regardless of what the product might be, with the intent of treating a disease, it's a drug. If you use it merely as with the intent of using it for nutritional support, then it's merely a food supplement. So chewing gum is a food. Coffee is a food. Truth of the matter is, coffee is really a drug. And I got in a battle with the Attorney General's office here in the state of California 1 year. And we were using a particular product that had sort of was a type of thing which could be either food or a drug. And I said, well, I asked the Attorney General, I said, what's coffee? And he said, well, coffee is a food beverage. I said, no, it's not. It's a drug because it contains caffeine. So you can't really define the difference, fine line. So I tracked back, there's a 1938 grandfather clause, and there's a 1969 grandfather clause. And under these clauses and regulations, if a food or a drug was used prior to 1938, then it's reliable, it can be accepted as an approved drug. It's not a new drug. the issue is whether it's a new or an old drug. Or if it was used prior to 1969, then the same thing applied. Then it's approved. It's not a new drug. But the thing is that when I trace these back, I trace the amygdalin back to find out whether or not, because the United States government was saying it was a new drug.
Now that's what Laetrile comes from, is
so
amygdalin, right?
I traced it back in publications to 1833, the drug dispensary of the United States of America. I traced it back to 1849, 1882, 1889, 1864, 1869, and so on and so forth. And then I found out that a drug, to be a legitimate drug, must appear in the United States Pharmacopeia or the Homeopathic Pharmacopeia or the United States Formulary or the United States Dispensatory. Those are the only official publications that were permitted. The Food and Drug Administration took all of those publications and twisted it to the place that said, well, those were not the same product as amygdalin. It was used 3,000 years ago. That's the never accept. It's used all over the world. Amygdalin is the most intensely studied thing since 1830. That wasn't acceptable to them. And they were able to twist scientific nomenclature dates to the place that they were not authorized under the 1938 or the 1998 or 1962 grandfather clauses. This is how your rights are lost. Your rights, your constitutional rights, are lost by legal distortions of scientific facts. This is the problem. That's what we're discussing tonight.
All right, fine. So it's been around for a long time. It's been used, and is Laetrile used in other countries? Is it allowed for cancer treatment?
Oh, yes. It's used in the Philippines. The last count I had, it's used in over 30 countries of the world.
So people could, Americans could go to other countries and
get
it.
Well, they do.
But they can't get it done here.
No. No one knows the exact numbers, but the numbers that have been thrown around is there's probably 50 million people over the years, decades of time, that have left the United States to get the freedom to use all kinds of compounds, not just Laetrile. But it may be Laetrile, it may be, other types of herbs. They've gone to the Orient, they've gone to Mexico. All you got to do is look at the works of Contreras, Ernesto Contreras, and it's pathetic.
Well, we'd like to talk a little bit about Dr. Contreras' results. Dr. Contreras, and now I believe his son, has been using Laetrile down in Tijuana for many years. And, of course, everybody scoffs. And, you go to a medical meeting and everybody scoffs at these Mexican doctors. But, of course, Dr. Contreras is a well-trained physician. He was even trained here in the United States, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. In fact, he went to the Dana-Farber Institute for studies. He was trained at the Mexican Military Medical School, Mexico City. He's a very knowledgeable, a very kind, a very good person. And integrity is uppermost in the work of Contreras. And he has shown, he's got thousands of cases that he's actually documented. I have all those cases. We have in this institute, we have the largest library in the world on amygdalin and Laetrile. Because I've got a lot of original works of Contreras, of Krebs, of on and on and on and on and on.
Well, Bill, basically, what sort of results does he get? Of course, I'm sure most of the cases he gets are terminal. I think I mentioned before, I ran into a lady in Southern California who had been sent home to die by her doctors after extensive surgery, after chemotherapy, after everything for a pancreatic carcinoma. And a pancreatic carcinoma is basically a death sentence.
Horrible.
And for some reason or other, she decided to go to Mexico. And now 10 years later, she's as healthy as you can now hope to be. I keep telling her she's got to come on the program. She keeps telling me that she'd like to, but she's just so terribly busy. But she knows Dr. Contreras, and really, first of all, it's so much cheaper to get your treatment down there than to get your treatment here. I mean, a fraction of what it costs treatment there. So they're certainly not in this for the money.
Well, Contreras, if you know anything about Contreras, why in his history, he's had thousands of cases, and has he cured? I finished a book a while back, and I wanted to deal with the issue, has Contreras ever made any claims of being a cancer cure, his Laetrile? Because he works with a factory down there very closely. He said never once, and I don't know of any patient he's ever told that he'd say, I have a cure for cancer. He's never told them that. He has gotten very good results. He's lost some patients. He will be the first to tell you that he does win them all. Same is true of Dr. Navarro in the Philippines. If you ask Navarro, you claim that this is going to cure cancer, and he'll tell you flat-footedly no. We do the best that we can. Some are going to win. Some of them are going to lose. I had a patient, a young girl that had a lymphoma. I sent her down to a clinic down in the Bahamas. The doctor, I'm trying to think of his name, well, I probably will later. He was using an extractive of some type from the immune system out of the blood, and he would re-inject it, and some of these patients got better and some of them did not. So he didn't believe in diet. And he didn't care whether the patient smoked. And this is a young gal in her 30s, and she was smoking like a chimney. Diet, she didn't eat any old thing. And she didn't do well, and she died. I knew an older woman that had pancreatic cancer that had been going down to this Bahamian clinic there for years, and she survived over 9 years. Now, I challenge anybody listening to this program to go to any doctor, any oncologist, and say, hey, what kind of results do you get in terms of your cancer chemotherapy or radiation or whatever in cancer of the pancreas? I've got a gal that works in a bank. She's dying of smoke like a fiend. She's dying of pancreatic cancer now. So you got all these different problems. And if they won't do the right things and you keep taking in carcinogenic agents, you're going to die. You're not going to win.
Of course, the whole idea is you have to get the immune system working. And really, the Laetrile actually works by releasing a cyanide compound in the area of the cancer. Would you like to perhaps cover how theoretically it does work?
Well, basically, a cancer cell apparently has an enzyme in it that tends to release the cyanide ion. And this has been debated by various biochemists, but apparently when there's a couple of things that happen. If you look at the degradation path, in other words, you take the biochemical pathway of Laetrol, you see that it goes into eventually two compounds. One is thiocyanate, which is a beneficial thing, which is low toxicity that helps to work on the cancer cell. The other thing that is very important is another product called benzaldehyde. So it produces benzaldehyde, and the benzaldehyde has an analgesic effect. So you have a combination of things. I wished I could tell you that everything is very direct, right to the point, but that's not how it works. The benzaldehyde makes the patient feel, helps them to feel little or no pain. It's an analgesic. That's very important, because now what kicks in is the psychoneuroimmunological aspect of your mind, your brain. So I feel better. I'm not sick. And now what happens, this has been well documented, a lot of it right down here in Loma Linda. Several big books have been published on it. Let's say, let me give you, get away from the drug, amygdalin, and Laetrol. Let's say that you watch a Laurel and Hardy movie, slapstick, you laugh your fool head off, you're just excited, it's funny, your immune system goes up. And we know this for a fact. But if you are, let's say, depressed, I'm sick, I've got cancer, I'm going to die. I know I'm going to die because I feel like I'm going to die. So cancer chemotherapy makes you feel even worse. So now your immune system goes down. Your T cells go down. Your killer cells go down. Your natural killer cells go down. This is all documented science.
I mean, your immune system will respond to your mental outlook.
It will respond to your mental attitude. And this is so well documented now that it's beyond any discussion or controversy. So why I get back to benzaldehyde is I feel good from the analgesic effect of the benzaldehyde. I now tell myself, well, I've been taking this and that and the other thing and vitamins and enzymes that go along with it. They don't use the amygdalin by itself, incidentally. The boys that are really into this field work with other enzymes and other nutrients and vitamins. So the study that they conducted one time, Mayo Clinic, was worthless because they didn't use the whole Laetrol metabolic therapy. And that's the thing that was discussed with the Bohannon, Judge Luther Bohannon in Oklahoma. They said, we try to get across to the judge that you have to use a number of things. And in the FDA has a sort of a mono pharmacy approach. Now they're beginning to change because I am working on a cure which we now know works for AIDS, and in that one we're using a composite. We're using a synergistic type of approach. So we asked the FDA, this is startling, recently, well, we've got 7 different plant products that we want to use. Can we do that? They said, yes, if you can show us that this is meaningful and important to the solution, the therapy. Well, there was a day when they... So FDA is changing. So at any rate, the point is that if you get into this mode of thinking... that now, wow, I'm feeling better. I feel less pain. My pain is gone. I must be getting well. So that kicks in your immune system. And we can actually show you electron micrographs that will show you how a lymphocyte, how the lymph node actually talks, chemically talks to a lymphocyte. So when you're feeling good, they've measured it. Then your immune system goes up because your lymphocytes are being released, and you've got a chemical interaction. It's magnificent. If you could think of anything better God-given than that, I don't know where it would be. So that's part of the program.
Okay, and so the patient that takes the Laetril, and first of all, they get this feeling of euphoria, and I've heard this from Dr. Burke told me about it, how good the patients felt. They feel good, and then, of course, then there's this secondary reaction going along with all the other treatments of the release of the cyanide, but only in the area of the tumor.
Right. Well, it's most sensitive to it because there's an enzyme called rhodanase that the tumor itself has, apparently, according to some biochemists, it has a greater abundance in the tumor system, which helps. In other words, it's these interactions where one thing trips off another. That's what this is all about.
Sure.
If you can think of the fact that the body is a biochemical symphony and realize that chemistry is literally like a musical symphony. You don't have a symphony if you have only a cello and a violin or a bunch of bass drums. You have to have all of it working in a totally integrated type of medicine. And that's why the whole field of medicine today is beginning to shift into the direction of what they call integrative medicine. What do we mean by integrative medicine? It means we're not throwing out all of the orthodox stuff. There are times we need surgery. There are times when we need radiation. There are times when we need chemotherapy. But you've got to do it in a way that's measured. You know in advance what the reaction you can expect to get out of it biochemically. You've got to know the effect on the mental, how the mind reacts to this. You can't be down and pain and feel good and get things to work because they energize each other and you eventually lose the problem. I would like to tell you the story, if I may, of the Joey Hofbauer story, because it shows you to what extent some of these regulatory laws will stoop. For example, in about 1997, there was a man, a little boy. He was about a year and a half old when he first discovered this, and he finally died, I don't know, very early in life.
What sort of a cancer did he have?
I think he had a lymphoma of some type.
Okay.
And I'm not absolutely certain about that. I've got it in the record here, but I'd have to dig it up. But the part of it that becomes very sickening and very sad is I was called as an expert witness back in outside of Boston, Massachusetts, and we were in a municipal court. The boy was taken from the parents by the state. The police literally came in, took the boy, and sent him to a hospital and said, "You are going to get cancer chemotherapy." The agents they wanted to give him were destructive to the liver, to main organs, and so on and so forth, and I couldn't believe it. So I tried to introduce it to the court, the fact that the cancer chemotherapy damaged the liver, and I said to the judge, I said, these are the, all of, this is the documentation from the National Cancer Institute. The judge's reply was, he said, doctor, did you conduct personally all these toxicological tests? I said, Your Honor, I didn't personally conduct all of those tests any more than you conducted all the court cases that make up our common law. I said, frankly, and I think he got the idea that I thought it was a stupid question beyond belief. At any rate, this kid, they fled with the kid. They took him to the Bahamas. They took him to Mexico. First took him to Mexico, where he got the Laetrone, was doing pretty well on it for a while. And then he had other problems down there, and so they took him to the Bahamas. The Bahamian government, our American Cancer Society, and the National Cancer Institute, and the state of New York, informed the cancer clinic down there in the Bahamas, that if you help this child for any medical emergency whatsoever, we will take away the license of the physician, of the nurse, even though you're in the Bahamas. That's how much control he had over. And this boy was refused. He developed a complication. He developed a pneumonia. Well, first of all, he couldn't get air conditioning because they couldn't afford it. It would cost them an extra $100 a month, which they didn't have. It was a poor family. But the diabolical activity of threatening to take the licenses away, the power of the state of New York, American Cancer Society, National Cancer, they were all involved. None of these were guiltless. To take the license away from those people that were offering to help this little kid. To me, this is unconscionable. I can't conceive of human beings acting like, but this is a documented fact.
Well, the tragedy is they seem to be much more interested in their power than they are in getting the child treated. And we see this in the last couple of years with Dr. Brzezinski and a little boy named Thomas Navarro. The family didn't want him to have full brain radiation because he could lose 10 to 40 points in his IQ. And the government said, you can't have this boy treated until he's had full brain radiation. And, you know, that everything was done to block the parents' desire to do what they felt was best for their child.
This was the Brzezinski case?
Yes,
Yeah, he's been horribly treated.
And, of course, the thing is that there are a number...
I know him quite well.
Right, there are a number of very effective treatments for cancer. In fact, we have a great four-tape set on Dr. Brzezinski's treatment as well as the book, Brzezinski Breakthrough. But the average individual doesn't understand that there is an organized effort, for whatever reason, within the FDA to block the release of that treatment, even though they know it works. The National Cancer Institute has said that it works. So it's just almost incomprehensible to me that anybody would want to see a child die.
Well, it was very disturbing to the Congress, and Congress was in an uproar over this very issue.
Right.
This is why the FDA today, at least among the, I think, the Republicans, is skating on rather thin ice. And let me say something about the FDA, because I've worked with them, and before I could go on to the World Health Organization as a consultant politically, my name, my background, my scientific
viewpoints, one thing or another, had to be approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. They could not hire me. They could not use me without their approval. And for five solid years, I had their approval, even though I've been fighting them in the courts. The United States Food and Drug has some magnificent scientists, some of the best trained, the most skilled scientists that you'll find anywhere. And people sometimes ask me, well, Holst, did you think, would you like to get rid of the FDA? Absolutely not. That would be absurd. It would be stupid beyond belief because they protect the lives of millions of people. And I can show you in the paralytic shellfish poisoning, for example, the food products that we eat. If we did not have their guidance, and we did not, get under their regulations, come within their regulations, we'd be fed slop and, we'd have lots of deaths.
Now, we're going to have to take a 3-minute break here. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Dr. Bruce Halstead, and he's actually got his medical degree a couple of years before I did. But right now we're talking about Laetrile, and we're talking about the real the way, the effectiveness that has been used effectively by doctors, not as a cure, but as a supplement to other treatments. And many people who have actually been considered inoperable cancers have actually improved and are continuing to live well. But if you don't take care of yourself, you're going to have a relapse. Don't you feel that's true?
Absolutely.
Okay, we've got Mike calling in here from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Hi, Stan. Just one comment from the end of the last hour.
Right.
On the Clinton presidential studies on radioactive material in humans.
Right.
This is just my opinion of it. Most often when these sorts of studies are being done, they're simply out to observe the results of programs that have been instituted over some number of decades. They're not really out to help us necessarily. I think we can use such studies to help us, but really what they're after is just simply to find out the results of things they've been perpetrating on us.
Well, let's get to Dr. Halstead's remarks, because I thought Dr. Halstead had a feeling that these were just so very revealing. Did you get Mike's point, Dr. Halstead?
Yes. I think it's a two-edged sword. They're both gaining on one hand, and know already before they even conduct the study some of the results, because plutonium, they certainly knew all during the Manhattan Project, which was involved in some of this. And the problem is that they were involved in violation of the Nuremberg Code. They were in violation of the Army Wilson Amendment. And this is the bad part, is that they didn't get anybody's permission. Most of these people, the mothers, the parents, the children that they were feeding the cookies to, plutonium waste cookies, were people that had mental defects. But they didn't reveal to the parent and say, madam, I'd like to use your child. I'm going to feed him some plutonium waste cookies, which are going to be deadly. Can produce deadly effects, biological half-life over a billion years, and may we experiment with your child. Now, how many mothers are going to say, yeah, sure, go right ahead and experiment, but they didn't bother to tell them?
I think the important thing is,
why do we condemn the Germans, Hitler's regime, Nuremberg? A code came out of this as a result of the world court, and we were in violation of it. Then we had an army amendment, the Wilson Amendment, that said that you can't do anything on a soldier or military. But we went ahead and exposed our troops in Bikini and a WETOC to deadly plutonium. They didn't get anybody's approval for anything.
I think the major thing is, Mike, at least we've got the documentation of it, and we can utilize that for our benefit. Okay?
Yeah, at least.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks so much. And right now, let's go to Lillian here. Lillian, how are you?
Well, hello there.
Fine. We got mute, but last time we punched you in, why we got this this funny music?
I guess thought I hung up on myself or something. But your program is fabulous as always, and you are the greatest man in America on the radio.
Well, thank you, but you don't want
I'll
to tell
hang
me that.
I'll
sort of
and ask a question.
All right, you go ahead and ask the question now.
All right, I'm a friend of mine, Colonel Johnson's wife. Had cancer, and it was in her armpit, and her arm was huge. It had already swollen so that she couldn't get any dresses or even a sweater on it. And so the doctor told her she had about 5 years to, I mean about 5 months to live with cancer. And her husband, Colonel Johnson, had been studying, reading a lot of things. He read everything about Laetrile. So he took her in the car, she was sick, and took her down to Old Mexico, and she took Laetrile treatment down there and lived 18 years after that. 18 years! Her arm stayed swollen all those 18 years, but she that cured their cancer, and so I'm sold on Laetrile.
Okay, anything else you'd like to say?
Yes, I'd like to tell you how much I appreciate your program and all the work and sacrifices and money and effort and energy you put into it. I think you're a great American patriot.
God bless you. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, there's another testimonial, and I think that, you know, there are an awful lot of people out there who've taken Laetrile after they've been simply written off by standard medicine. And I honestly believe that the reason physicians scoff at Laetrile is because all the medical journals tell them that they're supposed to scoff at it, and all the medical articles, you know, and you go to a meeting and everybody ridicules the people who go down to New Mexico, and then they always hold up Steve McQueen. Would you like to comment on Steve McQueen?
Well, Steve McQueen, as I understand it, the complication was in the surgery that he had. It wasn't because of the cancer of the Laetrile. It's the way Chad Green, when he died, there was no evidence of cancer. The problem that he had there is that the poor guy, there were several doctors that testified to the fact that this guy died of a broken heart. Now, you'd ridicule it and say, well, there's no such animal. Well, there is. And there are more than one person that has died of a broken heart. And this brings into the whole field of psychoneuroimmunology. But Steve McQueen, at least the information that I had was not, wasn't the cancer directly, but there was certain surgery that he needed, he didn't get, and he should have gone into the United States at the time, died because of a lack of it. So there you have it.
All right. Of course, they always want to hold up the people who didn't get well after Laetrile. They never want to talk about the people who did. And actually, if they're too far gone, the certain number of these people are just not going to make it no matter what you do. Isn't that true?
Well, Stanley, one of the problems that I got into the Judge Bohannon's court is the Food and Drug Administration, you may remember this, posted, they had big posters in all of the post offices saying, Laetrile may kill you. Laetrile is dangerous to your health, and so on and so forth. And they listed a number of reasons that one of these is that it contains cyanide. Cyanide is deadly. Well, it doesn't contain cyanide. It contains cyanide, by definition, is either a potassium or sodium cyanide, entirely different product. It is not cyanide ion. when you get cyanide iron, then in Laetrile, it goes on down to benzaldehyde, and it goes into thiocyanate, which is not the same. And we got it.